From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Popular imagery in 19th century France and England, this week on Soundings. My guests are Beatrice Farwell of the University of California at Santa Barbara and Robert Patton of Rice University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Beatrice Farwell about her forthcoming study of popular imagery and high art in 19th century France. Following that, a conversation with Robert Patton about his biographical study of the Victorian illustrator George Cruikshank. Beatrice Farwell's scholarship investigates the relationship between high and low pictorial culture in 19th century France, the century that saw the introduction of mass media for the reproduction of both word and image. Here is Beatrice Farwell.
What I'm interested in is what you see when you go into an art museum and you look at old master paintings, and then you come to a place in the museum where the subject matter changes along about the middle of the 19th century. And from that time on, painters pretty much are painting what they see. But the change was very radical when it happened, and it affected art from then till now.
Who spoke against it and who spoke for it? Help me to understand that.
For the change?
For this transition that occurred.
Well, there was a lot of resistance to it, and the resistance came from people who had got used to an older kind of expression in art and who were seduced by the old idea of beauty and uplift and all of those things that we now kind of joke about in art. But the official patronage of art in France was geared to that older schema of things. Art was always for the carriage trade, so to speak, in the past. It was for those who could pay for unique, wonderful objects. And except for the time when painters worked a lot for the church, because everybody could go to church, art was a really luxurious item. Mm-hmm. It still is.
B. Farwell, we're talking about your investigations into 19th century art, particularly in France. You talk about what you call socio-cultural causes and effects when you're trying to figure out this relationship between the artist and his audience and the sense of audience, demography, all of that. What have you got in mind when you talk about cause and effect in that respect?
Well, on a very literal plane, I'm thinking of somebody like the young Edouard Manet, painter, when he was maybe 14 or 15, first feeling that he had some talent in drawing, for instance, making pictures for himself that were like the pictures that he knew when he saw the books that he'd been given for Christmas or whatever. And for the first time, there were books with pictures in them. And we know that he had certain editions of certain books that that had pictures in wood engraving, and that he was well aware of that kind of pictorial culture, which has almost nothing to do with the large-scale oil paintings that great artists made. Now, in the same category, but not as high, let's call it lower, were a lot of the lithographs that were made not for books, but just to be seen in albums or to hang on the wall. And those who made the lithographs came to be specialists in that. Many of them were people who didn't try to compete in the world of high art, but who even were sort of hack artists, turning out stuff for a publisher that wanted to make a buck from what he was printing.
So something that was not art became an art form, at any rate, amongst these wide audiences.
In effect, yes. And the phenomenon I'm talking about has had very widespread consequences, because nowadays, in modern times, people have such various notions of what art is. You know, the pictures in a magazine or the pictures in a museum, they're different categories of things. But people even get kind of confused, I think, because of that.
You remind me of a phrase, I believe his name is Arthur Danto, a philosopher at Columbia, has written a book called The Transfiguration of the Commonplace. And he says you go into an art museum and an artist has placed a piece of hemp or a rope inside a frame, and you look at it and you come away with the sort of Peggy Lee, is that all there is effect. This is art. Who says this is art? How do I figure out that it is art? Are we stretching things to say that that sort of thing happened in the 19th century in France, that artists looked at commonplace objects and said, in effect, I'm going to make this art, and took it to a wide audience, which accepted the artist's definition?
It wasn't that easy. First of all, the artists weren't really trying to shove anything down anyone's throat.
Mm-hmm. They weren't trying to redefine art. It isn't.
No,
that.
No, really not.
Yeah.
And their own statements are that they have the greatest respect for the art of the past, uh-huh, and that they have no intention to be revolutionary or any such thing. I'd like to come back to Danto and that idea about transfiguration of the commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
Danto has become a kind of debunker of the kind of esoteric modern art that appears nowadays in galleries and museums. And I suppose that somebody could have done the same thing in the middle of the 19th century. When we talk about transfiguration, my idea about 19th century realist painters is that they were not trying to transfigure. They, in their own minds, I feel sure, were dealing with the pleasures of vision of the common world. And
Not trying to make it into something that it isn't.
That's right, because what they were doing was reacting against an art that had been doing that forever.
Uh-huh.
You know, making one thing stand for another, making unrealities in
deifying,
art.
Reifying.
Yes, and also one of the things they objected to was older art trying always to recreate a past time,
mm-hmm,
to paint history instead of to paint the present. And what happened was that these entrepreneurs that were putting out mass images were interested in making money, of course, and the pictures that they published were almost entirely on the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
They were all of common sights indoors and outdoors in the modern world.
You could be talking about what we see on television today.
We've
made the technological leap, but the substance, the content,
yep.
Well, maybe substance isn't the right word, but the stuff of it is more or less the same sort of thing.
Yeah. In fact, I've considered that lithography in the 19th century, well, it was the television of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. This all involves, you use another phrase here, B. Farwell, social mythology. And I get the sense that that's where we're headed here, as you try to explain, again, this very complex kind of problem, high and low pictorial culture in 19th century France. Are we on the right track there?
Yes, right. I think of what turned up in the lithographs as a social mythology.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between wood engraving and lithography in this matter, because wood engraving was used to be printed with texts, books, magazines, and so on, so that it's illustrative, or it could be cartoons and caricatures,
uh-huh,
that sort of thing. But lithographs that were made as single sheets were not associated with a text. They became a text in a way, and there were certain themes that were played on again and again and again,
mm-hmm,
and they become like a myth, like a social myth. There are examples like The Happy Mother, for instance.
Uh-huh.
That started actually in the 18th century, but there are pictures, just thousands of them, I suppose, showing a woman with children, happily kissing them, playing with them, and so on. And the title always is The Happy Mother. And when you get then to a painter like Degas, let's say, who's best known, of course, for painting ballet dancers, his subject matter runs a very similar gamut from, of these working class women doing their thing. He made portraits, of course, also, but he made pictures of laundresses, milliners, and bathing women. That's another category of this kind of imagery.
Yeah, that seems to have been a big, what, hang-up or fascination?
Well, it's pin-up.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Maybe a hang-up, but it's also a pin-up. these, plus, of course, scenes from the races, the horse races, or scenes in the theater. Not so much the stage, but the loges, where people, the audience became of interest. And pictures of this kind were made from the 1820s all the way up to the 1850s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
A whole range of urban subject matter. And these Degas picked up on. And I see them as myths, the myth of the ballet dancer, the myth of the milliner,
mm-hmm.
and the myth of the bathing girl.
Help me to understand how that comes to us in the 1980s. Do you look at it on its own terms 100 years ago, or are you saying in effect that it was something then and it has an impact on our artistic notions today?
Well, since we still have the pictures...
there it is.
It does have an impact.
Yeah.
And... art historians and museum people, for that matter, have pretty consistently pointed to the importance of these great artists, Degas, Manet, the Impressionists, Courbet.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanations of how they came to do what they did and the interpretations of their art have by and large been in terms of other art of the same kind, that is, of high art and aesthetic ideas.
Mm-hmm. The models that they
down.
Knew.
Yeah. And it seems to me that they have not sufficiently taken into account this kind of context that the artists grew up with and that surely affected what they did.
Are we doing that today in our appreciation or criticism or condemnation or praise of the artists that inhabit our culture?
Well, I think we're beginning to, and as a matter of fact, the artists are the ones who have really kind of understood this matter.
Uh-huh.
From the 60s until now, the whole phenomenon of pop art.
So you'd be talking about people like Andy Warhol?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
They followed in a way in the footsteps of those artists of the mid-19th century by about 100 years in embracing the world of ordinary existence and making art out of it.
You're telling me, if I read you correctly here, B. Farwell, that the artists themselves are the best art historians.
Absolutely.
Isn't that a little dangerous? Doesn't that, don't you have a vested interest in countering that kind of an impulse as an art historian?
I believe that the artists are always ahead of the art historians.
Uh-huh.
They point the way.
Beatrice Farwell teaches at the University of California at Santa Barbara. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Beatrice Farwell worked on a forthcoming study of popular imagery and high art in 19th century France. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Popular Imagery in 19th Century Europe continues now. My guest is Robert Patton of Rice University. Robert Patton is at work on a biography entitled The Life, Art, and Times of George Cruikshank. Bob Patton, you're at the Humanities Center writing a book about a man named George Cruikshank. He was once a household name. He's no longer a household name. Victorian illustrator. Tell me about him.
George Cruikshank, who will soon be a household name again, I hope, at least to listeners of Soundings, was born in 1792 in London, died in 1878. So he lived a long life, comparatively, for a Victorian. He produced about 10,500 drawings during his lifetime, began working with his father in his father's drawing studio. His father's a printmaker. When he was 9 years old, and probably even earlier, was coloring some of the prints, and went on in a kind of productive way until the end of his life. Beginning with the Napoleonic period, when England was prosecuting this enormously expensive war, it cost men, it cost a great deal of money, there were heavy taxes, and from that point forward, Cruikshank was one of those in Great Britain who shaped public dialogue. That's a very fashionable way to put things nowadays, but it's really true. Let's go back to the Napoleonic War and let me try to illustrate it. The trouble for England in fighting that war was that in some ways France had all the good arguments. France said it was fighting for the common man. It was fighting for the repeal of repressive oligarchical governments. England had somehow or other to levy an enormous tax on its citizens and at the same time say to them, hey, this is in your best interest. You don't really want a democracy. You yeah. want what we've got, which is a monarchy.
Well, what was Cruikshank's role in all of this? I take it as a commentator, a satirist, a propagandist, a lot of threads to tease out there.
That's right. He had somehow or other, along with his fellow propagandists and the government, to shape some kind of an argument which would engage the common man in England into this war effort. And he did it in a variety of ways. He wasn't alone in doing this, but after the death of some of the other leading satirists of the period, he was the preeminent figure. First of all, he did it by creating or helping to create an image of John Bull as the average Englishman.
Did he invent that?
He did not invent it. It was originally the first time John Bull appears. He appears in literature in a book by Dr. Arbuthnot in 1726, something like that.
Uh-huh.
But the figure comes out of the literary tradition and into a graphic tradition in the late 18th and early 19th century. And John Bull becomes that personification of the average Englishman. He is not terribly swift on the uptake. He's very burdened, overburdened by taxes, but he's a man of a kind of resolute strength, and he's also a person that doesn't want to be giving up his substance, his grain, his money, and so forth and so on, his children to war, without being certain that the government is finally prosecuting that effort as cleanly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Bob Patton, we're talking about your biography of George Cruikshank, the Victorian illustrator. Cruikshank had, in addition to his commentary, visual editorial on the Napoleonic Wars, he had an agenda with respect to social issues. For example, his father had died of alcoholism, and help me with this, he lost a brother or a brother-in-law, several people to alcohol, and that became a part of what he was doing in his illustration. Tell me about that.
That's absolutely right, Wayne. George Cruikshank's father, Isaac, was another major caricaturist of the early 19th century, late 18th and early 19th century, and like so many people in that era, he was a hard drinker. It was not at that point conceived of as a social problem. But one day in April of 1811, he was drinking on a bet and evidently consumed too much alcohol. And I have not ever seen any actual autopsy report, but in any case, he died. And that left Cruikshank, at the age of 19, responsible for bringing up the family. His older brother Robert had gone off to war, enlisted in the naval services, and was thought drowned at sea. In fact, he was abandoned on St. Helena and eventually worked his way home and walked into the house one day to the surprise of all the grieving relatives.
Goodness.
But Robert himself, for a variety of reasons, including apparently a wound in the head during that period of military service, took to the bottle rather heavily, and in the last 10 years of his life, Robert died in the early 1850s, he too was drinking too much. Now, Cruikshank drank an enormous amount as a young man, and he went out and stayed out all night and caroused, and he knew where you could go to bet on gamecocks and bears and every other form of gambling and entertainment in the metropolis. But in 1847, Cruikshank joined the temperance movement, and from 1847 to his death in 1878, he was the leading British propagandist for temperance, which was probably the largest social engineering movement of the mid-19th century.
All right, now, Bob Patton, in a way, that brings us to Charles Dickens, because odd as it may sound, Cruikshank had this war going on against alcohol, and yet that is one of the reasons, a disparity, a difference of opinion about this with Dickens that caused between the two men a falling out. Step back a little bit from what you're telling me now about Cruikshank and his campaign against alcoholism, and blend that in with his relationship to Dickens.
Cruikshank was the leading book illustrator after about 1820, 1822, and 15 years later, he and Dickens were married by a publisher on a particular project, illustrations for street sketches that Dickens had been publishing in newspapers. They got on very well together. They did an excellent job in collaborating on sketches by Boz in 1836, and the most famous of their collaborations was Oliver Twist, 1837 to 39. They went on being friends, although for a variety of reasons they were not able to collaborate on any more major ventures. And indeed, Cruikshank was an actor in Dickens's amateur theatrical companies in the late 1840s. But they slowly drifted apart as Dickens, who had initially, when he was a rather unknown young man, been identified as the Cruikshank of writers.
Yeah.
By 1847, Dickens was probably the most famous writer in the English-speaking world.
And he left the older man sort of behind.
And Cruikshank, his day was passing, and he was having a harder and harder time finding an audience for the kinds of things he was interested in. In 1853, looking hard for that audience once again, Cruikshank decided to tell some fairy tales and then to illustrate them in a way that he had done when he was the first illustrator anywhere in the world of Grimm's fairy tales back in the 1820s. Tried to revive the fame that he had achieved from doing those early fairy tales. But he decided in writing about them that he would have to explain why Hansel and Gretel were sent out into the woods, or why it was that Jack was so poor that he had to go buy beans and climb up to meet the giant. And so
or
forth.
Cinderella was neglected.
Yeah, and the reason was, of course, that the parents or the relatives drank. That was his little bow toward temperance.
And that brings us back, right.
Exactly. When Dickens read that those stories, he wrote an essay in a magazine that he owned and edited, called A Fraud Upon the Fairies, in which he complained that Cruikshank should have left fairy tales alone, that childhood imagination should not be tampered with by moral and didactic purposes. Now, of course, Dickens had been taking fairy tales and twisting them around in all sorts of fascinating ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk about somebody who should make such a charge.
Yeah, but what Dickens didn't like was specific didactic content. Furthermore, he had a fundamental objection to Cruikshank and teetotalism, because he believed that teetotalers were looking at a change in behavior in individuals when what they ought to be attacking was the underlying causes that drove persons to drink. Poverty, bad housing, you know, poor medical care, and so forth.
That's
so
certainly on. In keeping with the sort of thematic things that Dickens does in his novels.
Exactly. In something like Bleak House, it's an indictment of an entire society, or our mutual friend. So Cruikshank responded, but found that Dickens' popularity was such that the sale of his Christmas stories was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And since Cruikshank, as a working artist, had never had the kind of copyright protections, had never had the continuing income from back sales that someone like Dickens or Thackeray was to enjoy, Cruikshank was still scrabbling in the 1850s, 50 years after he first came to the notice of the public, simply to earn enough to keep himself and his wife in middle-class comfort. And to pay for that increasing family.
Did he die a bitter man because of this decline in his reputation, and or specifically the falling out with Dickens?
I don't think he was a bitter man at his death, but he was a frustrated man, and I think he was sort of fundamentally puzzled that nothing in the last 25 or 30 years of his life worked.
Yeah.
No way that he sought to recapture the public and the acclaim that he had once enjoyed really succeeded in the middle of the Victorian period. He had such extraordinary energy. He danced a hornpipe at the age of 83 to prove that he was not his own grandfather, because people thought it can't be the same man that I saw doing these squibs back in 1812, 1815. It's got to be the grandson.
Mm-hmm.
He had so much energy that he could never just become embittered and withdrawn. But he, as I say, was enormously frustrated.
Do we have to understand a lot about Georgian and Victorian culture to look at Cruikshank's political satires and understand them, to find them laughable or funny? Or are they universal? Do they speak to us in terms that we would recognize apart from a particular period?
I don't think it's an either-or situation. The answer is both and that's
okay.
What partly makes it so complicated to write about them. Yes, in any particular political satire, let us say, on George IV, you need to know who the characters are, why they're dressed this way, why people are taking this attitude toward what they've been doing, and sometimes this involves very minute footnotes in history. But at the same time, if the image works, if it's going to last, it draws on much deeper strains in the human psyche that we too can draw upon in our interpretation and response. One of the things about caricature, let me clarify that Cruikshank was a caricaturist and a satirist in the first, say, third of his productive life. He was a book illustrator in which caricature was still a strain, but he was doing some other things, more narrative and more realistic in that middle third of his life. So when I talk about caricature, I'm really talking about independent plates issued for shilling, or a couple of pennies or whatever, maybe one every two or three days for the public to buy up. In those plates in particular, they tap anxieties, they tap fears, they tap deep psychological processes. One of the things that Cruikshank was able to do that any good satirist or caricaturist must do is to retain some kind of intuitive feel for his own childhood, for those things in children that we find coming out of us as adults, those things that fairy tales address, fear, anger, jealousy, need, hunger, psychic hungers, not just physical hungers, that fairy tales and satire both address. Mm-hmm. So you can look at the political program of a particular plate, but you can also sense that the image is shaped by these much deeper and more lasting kinds of impulses. It's a very expressive art, like early 20th century expressionism.
Very quick footnote to our conversation, Bob Patton. If George Cruikshank were sitting here at a third microphone and you had an opportunity to put one question to him, what would you ask him?
George, what's the truth about your past? I can't track down and verify any one of the many legends about his forebears that he not only told over and over again, that he created in a sense to create himself, but that became such an important feature in his politics. He was a Scotsman, and he claimed that he had all of these connections to the great Scots events of the past. I can't find any of them.
Robert Patton teaches at Rice University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Patton worked on a biography of the Victorian illustrator George Cruikshank. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Popular Imagery in 19th Century France and England is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 406. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about politics and royalty in England, Ireland, and the Netherlands. My guests will be Charles Carleton of North Carolina State University and Vincent Comerford of Maynooth College, Ireland. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Image and the Audience, next on Soundings. Listen for Beatrice Farwell of the University of California at Santa Barbara and Robert Patton of Rice University. Beatrice Farwell discusses popular imagery and high art in 19th century France. Robert Patton talks about the Victorian illustrator George Cruikshank. Popular imagery in 19th century France and England. This week on Soundings.